for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama has chosen a community college in Northern Virginia as the place to sign legislation reforming the federal student loan system. He says it will save taxpayers $68 billion over the next decade and expand access to higher education for millions of Americans. To discuss what the changes will mean for students, families, and schools, here in the studio, senior writer for U.S. News and World Report, Kim Clark, and college counselor Nina Marks, with us from WFDD studio in Winston-Salem, is William Wells. He's director of financial aid at Wake Forest University. And throughout the hour, we do invite your calls, your questions. I know many of you are wondering about what this is going to mean for you, your child, your family, and the opportunity to attend the college of your choice. So join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org and join us on Facebook and Twitter. Good morning, Bill Wells. It's good to have you with us.
Good morning, Diane. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Nina Marks, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Kim Clark, it's good to see you again.
It's always a pleasure.
Kim, talk about the thinking behind these changes.
Right. Well, as we all know, the sort of private lending market kind of collapsed a couple of years ago. And so remember at late night TV, you used to be able to watch TV and see these ads. You know, if you're in college, you can get a check for $40,000 delivered to your house in 24 hours. Well, those have dried up. And as a result, everybody's just turning to the federal loan programs, the federal student loan programs. And the demand has just been incredible, and they've been filling the need for filling the demand for student loans.
Give us a brief history of those student loan programs, the federal ones.
Right. Okay. So back in the 90s, I guess it was back in the 90s, they created these great federal loan programs. They subsidized, the federal government subsidized interest rates and allowed every student, no matter how bad your credit, or the fact is most students don't have any credit, to borrow right now up to at least $5,500 and up to $12,500 at a very reasonable interest rate. That's called the Stafford Student Loan Program. And they created a parent loan program which allowed parents to borrow the full cost of attendance, less any other financial aid, for a little more money. It's a little more expensive. It's about 8% plus fees. So those are two great programs, and almost every student qualifies for the student loan. So the idea was to allow everybody to at least get enough loans to go to your community college or your in-state public university.
So, Nina Marks, from your perspective as a college counselor, how important do you believe this bill is that the president signed, which was included in the health care legislation?
Well, I think any effort at reform is critically important. I don't think we're doing enough. I think increasing, the Pell Grant by $200 a year is really the cost of one giant science textbook in one class in college. It's not going to transform anybody's ability to pay for a college of their choice. Still, it's better than nothing, and we know there will be further increases down the road. I think a more critical question is, how do we market to people who most need to understand what their options are, what their opportunities are? How do we market the opportunities for aid? We need to do a much, much better job, and I think it needs a systems overhaul.
And Bill Wells, turning to you now, how will things change for students seeking federal loans now from how they might have approached this 6 months ago?
Well, new students will not see very much change at all. We will continue to tell them how much they're eligible to borrow. In the new paradigm, they will no longer have to tell us which lender they prefer, so that step has been removed. We will then let the Department of Education know what each student's eligibility is. They will then transmit those funds electronically to us. They will go automatically to the student's account. For the returning students, there will be an additional step. They'll have to sign a new promissory note because they're shifting from the Stafford loan to the Ford direct loan. But that can be done online and should only take a very short amount of their time.
Now, you've answered one of my questions. I gather it is the Department of Education that's going to be administering these loans. Is that correct?
Well, the details of that, I think, remain to be fully seen. They will certainly be the dominant player in all of this, but there is some reason to believe that some of the servicing of the loan may be contracted out to some not-for-profit lenders that have participated in the old family education loan program.
So how much interest is there on these loans, Kim Clark?
Oh, there is. I just wanted to explain that this is so complicated.
Yeah,
the background of this. So
sure.
I'm just trying to make it simple. It used to be that the government paid Sallie Mae, everybody's heard of them, Citibank, like a bonus if they marketed a student loan to a student. They would go to a university and say, "We'll handle the marketing of the student these federally backed student loans for you. We'll take the application and we'll handle it for you." And eventually, the government provided the subsidy. The government guaranteed 97% repayment on the loans. So if the student defaulted, you and I were on the hook for 97% anyway. All this bill does is say, you know what, let's cut out the middleman. The government is going to take 100% of the risk, and it's going to keep 100% of the profit. We're not going to...
How much profit was there being made?
Yeah, there was a lot. Sallie Mae, as we all know, was a very, very profitable company for many, many years. And other companies that made student loans were very profitable. Recently, because of the credit crunch, it hasn't been so profitable, but it was very profitable for these companies. And that's why now we have $60 billion. The taxpayers now have $60 billion over the next 10 years to spend on Pell Grants and to reduce the deficit. That's how much the government is going to make by taking away these subsidies for private lenders.
However, I am still left with the question of how many students default on their loans, leaving you and me still responsible?
Well, as you would expect in this economy, the delinquencies and defaults are rising. Right now, the Federal Reserve estimates that 10% of student borrowers are in default, and that's up quite a bit in the last couple of years. They're in delinquency, I'm sorry. So we're seeing some real problems in repaying student loans.
And yet, Bill Wells, President Obama has said there's going to be $68 billion cut from the cost of this student loan program by going directly to the government and eliminating the middleman. Now, if you have the U.S. government as your, quote, bank, are you more likely to default than you might be if you had a private lender at your telephone saying, "You owe us money"?
Well, that remains to be seen. There will be some partnerships with some of these other entities, as I mentioned earlier, that may be involved in some of the servicing of the loans. There are also funds set aside in this new legislation to provide for deficit reduction. So there's going to be, I think, a lot of focus on this, and we just have to wait and see.
William Wells, he's Director of Financial Aid at Wake Forest University. Here in the studio, Kim Clark. She's senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. Nina Marks is a former college counselor at the National Cathedral School. She's founder of Marks Counseling Associates and the nonprofit Collegiate Directions, Inc. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Nina, how is this going to change the way you counsel college students about loans?
I work with two very different populations. In our client network, we work with students who are typically, in excellent high schools that have good support services available to them, that have networked families, and that have the great luxury of being able to consider college choices by virtue of the very best program available to them, wherever that may take them in the country or sometimes in the world. In our nonprofit work, we work with low-income, first-generation to college families for whom the process is, at the best of times, in the simplest of times, a maze. And what we discover is that it is critically important to know how to navigate and to negotiate. This becomes true not only in the actual admission process, but especially when you think, yay, I've got the good news, I'm into college, it's done, now I get to choose.
Now how do I pay for it?
Exactly. And how do I understand what my options and opportunities are at the end of the process? If there were one thing I could do, Diane, wave a magic wand, I would love to say, we've made the beginning of the college process so much easier for millions of kids with a common application form. Of course, there are supplements. Why couldn't we have a common financial aid form?
And that is a great question from Nina Marks. She's former college counselor at the National Cathedral School. We'll take a short break here, and I see the lines are filled. Send us your email, your tweets, and join us on Facebook. Welcome back. We're talking about the college student loan program with three very knowledgeable guests. On the line with us is William Wells. He's director of financial aid at Wake Forest University. Here in the studio, Kim Clark. She's senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. Nina Marks is a college counselor. She's founder of Marks Counseling Associates and the nonprofit Collegiate Directions, Inc. Here is an email from Matthew, who says, it seems every year we hear more and more federal money flowing into education to expand access to college for American students. Every year, tuition bills grow higher and more unreachable. And that's a question a lot of people are wondering about, Bill Wells. Will this new student program somehow manage to increase college tuitions?
Well, we don't think that increases in financial aid are cost drivers in terms of higher education. And the main things that are driving those costs upward are insurance for the people who work in colleges and universities. It's mostly human resource costs, paying faculty and staff. There are lots of additional requirements to report to state and federal government that require a lot of additional time on the part of additional staff. All of those things drive cost as well. We would always hope that we could provide as much financial aid and keep the cost down, the net cost down, as much as possible. We want as many students to attend our institutions as possible.
Kim Clark.
Yeah, actually, there has been some research into this, and this is a very controversial topic. The Pell Grant, the grant money, the federal grant money, there is no link between that and tuition increases, mostly because for many years the Pell Grant wasn't raised and tuition kept on going up. But there is some evidence that the increase in credit, the increase in borrowing and people's ability, for example, to borrow against their homes. Remember when your house was your piggy bank, that really enabled colleges to get these double-digit tuition increases. And now that the credit crunch has really hit and people are much stingier, you're seeing colleges announce very small tuition increases. So you're seeing an effect of the economy, the market, the larger market, and competition on tuition prices.
Kim, one other question. What are the fees involved in college lending here? If I have a child and I fill out this form, I submit the form to the Department of Education, I presume. What are the fees involved?
Okay, well, the first word in FAFSA, the first letter is F for free, so there's no fee in filling that out. You can certainly pay someone to fill it out, just like you can pay someone to fill out your 1040, but that's your choice. And when you get the loan, there's a 1% upfront fee for the Stafford loan, the student loan, and parents pay a 4% fee for their Parent Plus loan. So there are some fees for getting the loan, but usually they just add it on to the cost of the loan.
And, Nina, you have felt that the form itself has been too complicated in the past. Has that now been simplified?
Yes. The new FAFSA is much easier to navigate. The CSS profile, the form that is used by private colleges, can be still quite complicated for people. But really, what needs a global look is the way all the information is delivered. What happens right now is that typically students are notified that they are into college perhaps in late March or maybe by the very beginning of April. And colleges expect universally in this country a May 1 notification response date. I'm coming to you, I'm not coming to you, I'm accepting a place on your wait list, so forth. What we see is the month of April becomes an extraordinarily stressful time for anybody navigating that choice, but particularly for low-income families, because even with a regular admission decision, you do not necessarily get your financial aid package. And frequently when you get your package, as we've discovered with our Collegiate Directions families, we're in meetings this week and the whole of this month with families and students, helping them to navigate financial aid offers. It requires a level of financial literacy and comfort that is missing precisely with the people who need the help most.
And Bill Wells, is that how you see it?
Well, there are always the dual issues of access and simplicity, as well as having sufficient information and validity of that information to make some very fine distinctions about which families need those funds the most. And so colleges and universities like my own do use the College Scholarship Service profile of the College Board to gather a lot of information that the much simpler free application for the federal funds does not gather. We feel like we have to have that to ration, if you will, the very limited dollars that we're all trying to stretch as far as possible.
Of course. And Kim, here's an email from Rebecca. She says, will this change anything for people who are having trouble paying on current student loans?
Actually, there's great news for people with student loans and thinking about borrowing. Last year, the Obama administration created something called income-based repayment. That meant anybody with a federal student loan, not a federal federal parent loan or a private loan, but a federal student loan, could call the Department of Education, sign up for – consolidate their loan with the federal government and sign up for something called income-based repayment and make sure that their payments never exceeded 15% of their household income. And as a result of this bill, starting in, I think, 2014, you can limit it to less than 10%.
Suppose they're unemployed.
Right. You have zero income. Or you're getting very – I mean, your payment could be a dollar. It's less than 10% of your income starting in 2014, but right now you can limit it below 15% of your
income. So that starts in 2014.
Right now you can go to you should sign – if you have problems, sign up for it right now because at least you'll cap it below 15% of your income. And if you're only getting $1,000, you know – if you're under poverty, your payment's probably zero.
All right. There are so many callers here. I do want to open the phones. But first, we have James Boyle on the line from McLean, Virginia. He's the president of College Parents of America. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Diane. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And you?
I'm fine.
Good. In terms of families, what does this legislation do?
Well, not a lot at first. I mean, basically, it raises the Pell Grant by $200, which is less than 4%. And the Pell Grant is for the neediest of students. And frankly, the money that will come from additional Pell Grants really doesn't go into the pocket of students. It goes directly to the universities. Any student who is eligible for a full Pell Grant is probably going to get significant financial aid from the university. So essentially that $200 is just $200 less that the university provides the student.
All right, let me stop you right there. Kim, $200 for the neediest of students does seem like a minimal amount. How come?
Well, that's all they could afford to provide. I mean, you look at the demand for Pell Grants. So many more people are applying to go to school.
I see.
I mean, I'm just going to give you some numbers. Last year, the government handed out just a little more than 6 million Pell Grants. This year, 8.5 million. So you see a lot of unemployed people going back to school. And so they're sending out a lot more money, and the size of the grant is getting bigger because people are needier. Last year, the average size of the grant was $3,000. This year, it's $3,400. So you add $200 on top of that.
Exactly.
And it really starts to add up
to the
money.
Okay, Jim, and you feel, I gather, that costs at universities have gone up a great deal.
Yes, and with all due respect to the guest from Wake Forest University, I mean, to blame the cost on insurance and filling out of federal forms, I mean, that's really kind of cost at the margins. The cost of colleges and universities is solely on the personnel. I mean, schools have 75 to 80% of their costs are in personnel. And tenured professors who tend not to teach many classes and stay for many, many years create kind of a weight of costs on top of universities. And they are passing this cost on to parents, mainly because everyone understands that a college degree is essential to succeed in today's society. And so with, you know, economics 101 comes to play, there's a relatively fixed supply of seats at America's colleges and universities, and there's this overwhelming demand for those seats. And the colleges and universities, you know, raise their prices because they can.
All right. Nina?
I couldn't agree with you more, Jim. I think what's happening is, in addition, that many colleges and universities are, not all, but many, are making a choice of attracting or trying to attract students in whom they might have a particular interest with merit money. These may not be financially needy kids, and some of the potential funding goes to attract those potentially high-end students whom, you know, I can agree from my years in college counseling would add a great deal to the campus and the community. But that's money frequently out of a pot that might be used for our most at-risk, you know, low-income kids, 11% of whom right now are attaining, not only getting into college, attaining a bachelor's degree compared to 55% of their more affluent peers.
And Jim, finally, what more would you like to see the administration do?
Well, I think what this bill shows, frankly, is what the limited role that the federal government can do to lower college costs. What I would say is that the vast majority of students go to a public university in their own state, and that is incumbent upon people to put pressure on their own state legislatures and governors to support higher education, because it's those state subsidies that historically have kept tuitions low for students attending a school in their own state. Those subsidies have gone away in good times and in bad over the last 20 years, and it's been made up, in effect, by asking people to pay higher tuition.
Kim?
Yeah, that's true. What we've seen is a federalization of student aid. You see states like California, state of Washington, Illinois, Wisconsin, they're cutting the payments that they make to universities, and they're cutting their own state grant programs. So students are trying to go to the federal government to get aid that they are no longer getting from their state government.
So that, as you see the states running out or running low on money, federal government is cutting subsidies to states, so it's all getting squashed down to the bottom.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that how you see it, Jim?
Yes, unfortunately. And I think when it comes to private universities, I would agree with Nina that there's too much of the money is misdirected to students who don't necessarily need the financial aid, and that causes the sticker price of the school to go up and making it seem even more out of reach to those families who are looking to go to college.
Jim Boyle, he's president of College Parents of America. I know you have another interview to get to on Capitol Hill. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We have many callers. I want to get to as many of them as we can. First to Provo, Utah. Good morning, Kit. You're on the air.
Hi. I just kind of gotten through this whole college application process, and I'm just getting, responses from schools. And the only financial package I've received so far was from NYU. And they essentially left me with about $35,000 to pay if I were to go to their school next year. And, you know, that's more than half of my parents' income. So obviously that is completely out of reach. They offer me these loans to take out to pay for it. Now, I happen to know that, I'm going to go into writing. And if I were to graduate with somewhere over $100,000 of student loans, that could potentially be disastrous for my life. So I know not to do that. But I don't think a lot of 18-year-old kids do. I think that, when these schools wave this golden carrot of these dream schools in front of these kids and then say all you have to do is go $100,000 in debt to pay for it, I think a lot of kids are going to do that. I think a lot of kids are going to really get themselves in trouble because these schools are offering these obscene loans to these kids. And, you know, we got mad at these subprime lenders who gave house loans to people who realistically couldn't pay it back. And we get mad at, we call these payday lenders predatory. What I'm saying is that this is predatory lending.
All right. And Kim, is that how you see it?
Well, it's certainly true that there's sort of a big disconnect between people who fill out their free application for federal student aid, their FAFSA, and they get back a number called their expected family contribution, which is what the government thinks they can pay. Now, I've done the analysis. Only 66 colleges in the country, 66 out of more than 3,000 four-year colleges, provide enough aid so that all students only have to pay their EFC. Everybody else leaves what's known as a gap, and they fill that gap with a loan. And NYU is quite famous, actually, for leaving rather large gaps. So it's shocking that the government tells you that this is what we think you can afford and almost no schools actually provide you enough money so that you can afford college.
Nina, what would you say to Kit?
Kit, as a follow-up question, have you received offers from other colleges?
No, I've just barely started hearing back, so this is my first financial package.
Okay, because one of the things that we have found is when I was talking earlier about having a common college aid form, I really meant not only that the FAFSA has been simplified, but it's so helpful for you right now to have information from other colleges, other offers to compare, and therefore to be able to negotiate. This is critical, so don't rush to do anything until you get some more news. You should be prepared for the fact that the news that you get may be difficult to understand. One of the things we find very hard as we help students is loans and awards and, you know, everything is all mixed up. So you do need to look carefully.
Nina Marks is a former college counselor at the National Cathedral School and founder of Marks Counseling Associates. Short break and more of your questions, comments. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at Hewlett.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at WTGrantFoundation.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Roxana Subiri talks about her imprisonment in Iran, where she was accused of spying for the CIA. In the hope of getting released, she made a false confession. Soon after, in the hope of being able to live with herself, she recanted. After international calls for her release, her sentence was suspended. She's written a new memoir. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And we're back answering your questions on student loans, how they are made, when they are made, who makes them. Let's go to Oakland County, Michigan. Good morning, Marty.
Good morning, Diane and guests. I have a daughter who's in her early 30s who is going back to graduate school. She's already accepted. What kind of programs exist from this new federal legislation to help her? She really, without that, she's not going to be able to do this degree.
Okay, Kim.
Okay, so the bad news about going to a graduate school is there is very little grant aid available.
It's mostly undergraduate.
The grants, Pell Grants only go to undergraduates.
Pell Grants.
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay.
And most states only provide grants for undergraduates. What she can get is a loan. Now, if she's going to get a teacher's degree, she can get a forgivable loan. if she's going to work, go to school and then go work for a public service organization, the government or some nonprofit, she can take advantage of this new program that will allow her to make these 10 years of income-based repayments. And since she won't be making very much if she's in public service, they won't be large payments. And then after her 120th payment, the rest of the loan will be forgiven. So,
okay, let me just underscore that, because we've got an email here from Becca who says, is it true that if I, as a college graduate, take a job with the government or a nonprofit organization and work for that organization for 10 years, then after 10 years, the loan will disappear? I heard this was true if they keep up with their regular payments for all 10 years. But I've also heard this was an idea of Obama's and has not yet been created.
It is true. It's going on right now. And in fact, if you sign up right now, you might even get some credit for past payments. So you should call right away.
I'm glad to hear that. Let's go to John in Mays Landing, New Jersey. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a current college student. I'm pursuing a second degree right now, trying to get a teaching certification and a BA in education. I already have one in history. And now, this year, since I already have a BA, I might not get as many student loans in order to be able to pay for my tuition, which kind of puts me in a tough bind, because if, I can't get enough money to pay for this next certification and degree, there's not really much I'm left to do with a history degree, and I can't afford to go to school otherwise. So I was wondering if this legislation might affect my situation at all.
Right. The bill doesn't affect you, but there are terrific opportunities for you. In some cases, you can get an extra Pell Grant if you're pursuing a teacher's degree. Secondly, you should definitely be able to get a Stafford loan, which should pay for it. And thirdly, you should check out something called the Teach Grant, which unfortunately is not a grant, even though it's called a grant. It's actually a forgivable loan, specifically designed for people training to be teachers.
Now, are all these forms, is all this information available on the web?
Absolutely. You go to the Department of Education's website and just Google for, whatever you're looking for, the Teach Grant. Make sure you go to a Department of Education website, not some cheesy
Bill otherwise. Wells, do you want to add to that?
Well, I think it's important to understand what an investment colleges and universities are making in providing financial aid to students in addition to the federal grant dollars. Here at Wake Forest, 84% of the grant dollars going to students are institutional dollars. And those are mostly going to students with need. Fewer than 5% of our students receive any type of merit award that's not based on need at all. And those dollars are coming from old gifts that were made to the university years ago. They're totally endowed. So there's a lot of effort going on in many places to increase access to higher education.
All right. To Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
I'm a college student right now, and I live in Georgia, and I'm attending college in Georgia. And there's something called the HOPE Grant in the state of Georgia that is funded by our lottery system and allows a person with a B average who graduated high school in Georgia to attend college, public college, essentially for free, which has been wonderful for me. But they capped it a couple years ago, and it's not going to cover my entire bachelor's degree, so I'm out for the next two semesters. I was wondering, the Pell Grant, are the criteria to allow people to receive the Pell Grant going to change, or is it simply the amount that the people who are already eligible that's going to change, the amount they receive?
It'll go up just slightly. Basically, the Pell Grant goes to students whose parents earn less than about $45,000 a year. It's the lowest income 25% of the population.
And okay. So does that include you, Jessica?
Well, it probably will by next semester.
By next semester. Okay, well, good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
And now to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Mark. You're on the air.
Good morning. I have a question. I went to graduate school and ended up having to take out a lot of loans, and I was a little bit foolish, and they let me take out a lot of loans. So I ended up with $140,000 getting my biology PhD, and I now teach at a community college in St. Louis that predominantly serves minorities, and I'm paying about $700 a month that'll go up to over $1,000 a month on the student loan. And I do night jobs, you know, at the universities locally, so I exceed $100,000 income. So that doesn't make me eligible for the forgiveness program. But I was wondering if there's anything else out there, because, you know, just to meet those loans and maintain a reasonable quality of life, you know, I've got moonlight, essentially, and I end up with 12-hour work days.
Some employers do offer loan repayment or loan forgiveness. For example, the company that owns Carrier Elevators, they offer some great education benefits. The government, federal government, offers some loan repayment. I mean, you could consider looking for employers that offer loan repayment as a benefit.
But he's employed by a community college and earning about $100,000 a year. Bill Wells, from your perspective, would that rule out any forgiveness of loans?
Well, most of the reduction in payments are based on income or public service. And so those criteria are quite specific. And I think it would serve him well to go to the Department of Education website and just examine what the criteria are and see if he qualifies for any kind of loan reduction.
Kim,
I just want to point out, if you're making $100,000 a year, I mean, is really $700 a month for your loan, is that really unreasonable?
Mark?
Oh, no, it's not unreasonable. But if I didn't moonlight, if I didn't take a second job, then I would drop down to about $55,000 a year, and then it would be quite a burden.
Well, it sounds as though there aren't too many alternatives here except to pay off the loan as best you can. And actually, from the perspective of our guests, you may be one of the luckier ones. Thanks for calling. Let's go now to Debbie in Berwick, Maine. Hi there. You're on the air. Go right ahead, please.
Yes. I just wanted to add a comment about the suggestion to try to negotiate with the school of your choice based on a financial package or packages that may have been offered by other schools that had also accepted the student. I believe the student was talking about NYU. And I just wanted to say, I had been told the same thing at the time, that you could do that, and my oldest child was accepted to Sarah Lawrence College. She decided that was the school she wanted to go to. The tuition was quite high, or all the expenses were quite high, and my daughter had been offered very, actually wonderful financial aid packages by a couple of other schools. And in fact, the president of Sarah Lawrence College had written my daughter a personal note telling her what a wonderful essay she had written in her application to Sarah Lawrence. I thought maybe I'd have a chance at this negotiation thing, and there was a flat no. There wasn't even a discussion. And I was a little shocked. And I was aware that their endowment at that time was the whole financial problems hadn't occurred, and their endowment was you know, impressive. So I would just say I wouldn't count on that.
Mm-mm. Bill Wells, how much negotiating does Wake Forest University engage in?
Well, as I said, most of the financial aid is based on need, and we spend a lot of time trying to really get it right when we're determining how much need the family has. We read everything in their application about extenuating circumstances. We may follow up for additional information so that we can use professional judgment to make some change in how we would calculate the eligibility. We try to get it right the first time. If we don't, if there's something that we've missed that's going on in that family's financial circumstances that they didn't tell us about, then we encourage them to let us know, because we might go in and re-examine what was done and see that we missed something significant. But as far as just negotiating when there are not any unusual and extenuating financial circumstances, I think most schools really are not in a position to just increase aid because another school has said, you're going to get more from
us. I see. All right. Go ahead, Kim.
I just want to point out that's certainly true for most public colleges, but some private schools make it very clear. Harvard has said, send us your other offers. Carnegie Mellon says...
Oh, really?
They put it right on their website, fax us your other offers.
Huh.
That's exactly what I was going to say, exactly
but
what we have found.
But wouldn't Sarah Lawrence have been in that category?
It depends, frankly, also on how they read that family's need.
Yeah.
You know, if there Bill Wells on the Wake Forest website makes, I think, Bill, the video that you have really humanizes your explanation of how Wake Forest handles financial aid. I think that's very helpful. The first issue is particularly for people who are struggling to understand the system, let alone negotiate anything, is what is expected of them? Have they sent the right information? Too often we find with our low-income families, they're missing forms that either they may have been lost, but typically they didn't fully understand the directions. So there's a lot that just a human presence can do to reassure, and a clear explanation of deadlines.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out, Sarah Lawrence, it may be a school that looks at the competitive structure of the students' other options. So if you have a great offer from Podunk University, they're going to say, sure, you can go to Podunk
Take
University
it.
For less, but if you want to go to Sarah Lawrence, you're going to have to spend more.
That's
and
often the case.
You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And here's a question sort of going back in history from Randy, who says there was very little borrowing when I went to school. What happened? What is the history of student loans before the 90s, and how did it become abusive with colleges taking kickbacks from lenders? Kim.
Well, what happened is, we've talked about it, tuition has risen so much faster than families' income and faster than inflation. You know, you used to be able to go to an Ivy League school for, you know, $10,000 or $15,000, and now it's $50,000. So to make up that gap, loans came into play. And so that's the only way people could afford a, you know, private school education anymore. And so that's what people did. They started
One
borrowing.
Has to wonder whether at some point college costs will begin to level off.
Right.
I mean, this constant year after year increase with, as you say, family incomes not
right.
matching them. I just don't know how we can keep going in that direction. Let's go to Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning, George.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine.
My question, I'm disabled, and, you know, I've gone to school. I wanted to go to graduate school, and funds are extremely limited. And, of course, my ability to earn income is limited because of my disability, thanks to Social Security. I also have a significant amount of money that I owe. I've gone through I'm in foreclosure, gone through Chapter 7 a few years ago. I don't know that there are any options for someone like me. And, as you said, graduate school, it's basically borrow money.
Yeah, actually, the Department of Labor has been given a lot of billions of dollars to fund workforce retraining grants that can pay for some college courses or some training. So you might go into what's called your one-stop career center or your unemployment office, whatever you call it in your state, and ask about retraining funds.
And here is a final message, a tweet from Joy, who says, my children are 30 and 32. Their lives are on hold, one with $30,000, the other with $80,000 in debt. No money to pay. The interest piles up. Future looks destitute. Their problem is ruining their lives. No credit. They can't get jobs. can't make payment on loans, threatening their mental state. But she says these are all federal loans, not private. The collectors are vicious threats to even the parents.
Yeah, well, those people absolutely should immediately call and ask about income-based repayment. They are prime candidates for this, and this could really solve a lot of their problems.
Well, why don't people know about that yet?
It's brand new, I talk about it all the time. It's a great program.
Okay, so let's hope that this morning's program has helped to educate people that there is some help out there, not a whole heck of a lot, but there is some help. Go for it. Kim Clark of U.S. News and World Report, college counselor Nina Marks, Bill Wells of Wake Forest University, thank you for educating people this morning. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.